and report every procedure, they shut you down. Whole hospitals. They've actually done it. Not often, but enough times that it's put the fear into every medical and research facility in the country.
Why do they do it?
They're the watchdog. There has to be some central control. Look at human cloning at the turn of the century. Even though it was illegal, some lab facilities were still doing it because the checks and balances were so weak. And then there's biogel. That alone is probably responsible for Congress even establishing the FSEB.
Alice is still talking, but it's a garbled echo.
Biogel. Father's work. I can hear Lily saying it again. He made a big splash.
Biogel?
It changed everything. It made almost anything possible.
What do you mean? I ask. Alice raises her eyebrows.
You do have big blanks, don't you? Well, blue goo, as the hospital calls it, is, well, blue.
Brilliant, Ethan interjects.
And, Alice says, raising her voice, it's artificially oxygenated and loaded with neurochips. They're smaller than the human cell and communicate with each other pretty much the same way neurons do, except faster. And they learn. Once you've loaded them with some basic information, they pass on information to other neurochips and begin to specialize. And, of course, the truly spectacular thing is they can communicate with human cells in the same way. You pack a human or lab liver in biogel, and the neurochips do the rest. Deliver oxygen, nutrients, communicate with the central database, until it can be transplanted into someone who needs it.
Isn't that a good thing?
Sometimes, but just because we can doesn't mean we should. That's what the FSEB considers.
How so? I ask, trying to sound only mildly interested.
Well, one way is point values, she says. Everyone gets a lifetime maximum of 100 points. My limbs, for instance. The implanted digital technology to work with the prosthetics is very low point value. 16 points for all of them. But a heart? That's worth 35 alone. Throw in lungs and kidneys and you're at 95 points.
That sounds simplistic, I say.
Maybe, but fair, too. It doesn't matter how rich or important you are. Everyone's in the same boat, and medical resources and costs are kept under control.
What about brains? Ethan asks. What are they worth?
Brains are pretty much illegal. Only biodigital enhancement up to 49% is allowed to restore some lost function, and that's it.
That's an odd number, I say.
Why only 49%?
You have to draw the line somewhere, don't you? Medical costs are a terrible economic drain on society, not to mention all the ethics involved. And by restricting how much can be replaced or enhanced, the FSEB knows you are more human than lab creation. We don't want a lot of half-human lab pets crawling all around the world, do we? I think that's the main point of it all.
And the FSEB is always right? Ethan asks.
Alice sits up straighter, and her words come fast and clipped.
They're trying to preserve our humanity, Ethan. How can anyone argue with that? They're protecting us, and I for one think that is quite admirable. Plus, I happen to know there's a lot of very intelligent and qualified people in that agency.
Ethan pulls into the parking lot at the charter.
All I know is that a lot of intelligent and qualified people screwed up my life 2 years ago.
He throws the gear into park.
So much for intelligence, huh?
It seems our conversation has taken a sudden turn that I wasn't expecting. Ethan's voice is rigid, like the day I called us all freaks at the market. He leaves to go into the charter, not waiting for us.
Alice lets out a huff of air. He can really go off sometimes.
She rolls her eyes and reaches for her braces. I watch him walk away, wondering if his life changed just about the same time mine did. And like me, he's still getting over it, though I don't know what the it is
and I'm afraid to ask. But I'm sure it's why he's at the Charter now. I wait outside for Ethan to take me home. I've already conferenced with Ray, and now Ethan's conference is going over. Hello. Dane surprises me from behind. I haven't talked to him much since that first day. He's been out. Ray didn't say why, and Mitch only groaned when Alice asked. How are things going? His voice is warm and eager, and I like the sound of it. But I also remember what Ethan said about him. Good, I answer. Like your project? Yes. Need a ride? No. He blows out a very heavy breath, obviously annoyed at my short responses. He swings around in front of me and grabs my hand. Come on. Has Ethan been saying bad things about me? You're not gonna listen to him, are you? His hand is warm, firmly clasped around mine. I look up and I'm surprised at how closely his eyes match the color of the sky behind him. I have a problem, he says. I admit it. I'm honest. Like when I said you walked funny? I don't think any less of you because you do. And I didn't mean anything bad by it. You're not going to hold that against me, are you? No. He loosens his grip on my hand, but I notice he doesn't let go. We all have our problems, and Ethan's is he can't deal with the truth. He can't even tell the truth. I'd stay away from him if I were you, but I guess you'll figure that out on your own. You're obviously smart. He smiles, but it doesn't mesmerize me like the day I first saw him at his house. I'm changing daily. I can see things in faces that I couldn't see just a few days ago. Things that I think other people can't even see. And what I see in Dane's perfectly beautiful face disturbs me. Emptiness. The word is strong in my head, and yet I wonder if it could be the wrong one. Friends? He asks. Friends. That's why I wanted to come to school in the first place. Maybe Dane had friends like I once did. Friends who are gone now. And he misses them the way I miss Kara and Locke. Friends. I repeat because I know it would be rude not to. And because I think, maybe. Maybe. Then I'll stop by sometime, since I live just down the street, he says as he walks away. Sure. Thanks for the invite, neighbor. He calls over his shoulder. Did I invite him? Contents. Empty. Adjective. 1. Containing nothing, having none of the usual or appropriate contents. 2. Vacant, unoccupied. 3. Destitute of some quality or qualities. Now, a day later, I wonder what friends means to Dane. I wonder at his voice that is so different from his eyes. I wonder if I know anything at all. But I do know this. The word I felt when I looked into his face was the right word. Home. The house is empty. Saturdays are empty, I decide. There's no banging. No restoration, no school, no anything. Mother left early in the morning. She didn't tell me where she was going, but asked me to stay close by. I wanted to say no, but I didn't. Lily's been out in her greenhouse all morning. She didn't invite me to join her. I wouldn't want to anyway. I've looked out my bedroom window twice, trying to see what she's doing, but most of the inside of the greenhouse is out of view. I don't care what she's doing. I lie back on my bed and look at the ceiling. A Cotswold ceiling is fairly uneventful. It matches me. Mother and Lily don't know, but Father was right. My memory is coming back. It's curious how it comes. Each day, a rush of pieces, loosely connected, unimportant bits, snake through me. They click, click, click into my brain, like links being snapped together. And then they are done. A small chain of memories that fill in one tiny part of my life. They come out of nowhere. And most are not important. I remember shopping for socks, feeling the socks, paying for the socks, looking at the receipt for the socks. Every detail of a sock shopping outing that happened 5 years ago. Who cares about socks? But then others, those come out of nowhere too. Last night, in the hallway, I was dizzy with the rush of this memory. I had to lean against the wall in the dark and close my eyes. It was so clear. I was sobbing, screaming for Mother. I saw her crying, a tear briefly before she walked away. I cried for her to come back. I tried to reach out for her, but Father held me back. No, he held me. I was a toddler, maybe 18 months old. I wore a bright red coat, Father a black one. He kissed my cheek, wiped my tears, promised she would return. I kicked my feet. He held me tighter. I remember it like it was yesterday. How can I remember this? If I have to remember a lifetime of memories, bits at a time, will it take me another whole lifetime to reclaim them all? Or one day will they all connect up and explode inside of me? I peek out my window again. No sign of Lily. The floor creaks beneath my feet. I walk to the other upstairs rooms. They're all still empty. Will Claire ever fill them? But with what? With only me? I go downstairs. I've never really properly explored the downstairs rooms. Other than a hurried rush to Claire's bathroom when I cut my knee, I've never spent any time in the rooms beyond the hallway. It only just now strikes me as odd that I've been like a house guest, confining myself to my room and the shared rooms only, never feeling free to roam the rest of the house. Stay close by, Jenna. I am. I go to the first doorway on the right in the downstairs hallway. Lily's room, I think. I push open the door, but it's an office. Claire's office, by the looks of the blueprints, fabric samples, and design books. It's cluttered and disorganized. Not what I would expect of Claire. I move to the next doorway on the right. I turn the knob. The hinges squeal, startling me. Mother has still not updated the hardware and keys of the house. Maybe she thinks it makes the Cotswold more authentic, but it makes moving about unnoticed much more of a challenge. I find a large room, simply furnished. Yes, Lily's room. A pair of her shoes sits neatly in the corner. On the bureau is a scattering of framed pictures. Claire, my grandfather and Lily, and another one of a little girl in a pink party dress and black shiny shoes. A little girl who holds Lily's hand. The little girl Lily loved. I walk over and lay it face down. So what if she knows? What can she do, hate me? I feel empowered and I kick her shoes out of alignment, and I'm amazed that such a small action could feel so good. Enough of Lily's room for one day. The next door on the left side of the hallway is locked. I move on to Claire's room. The master suite is large. Adjoining the bedroom is a sitting area furnished with two overstuffed chairs and a small library. An arched doorway on the other side of the bedroom leads to a dressing area, closets, and a bathroom. The closets form the same odd tunneling arrangement as mine does. Multiple closets for different needs. Overkill. The largest closet has another door at the back of it that leads toward the center of the house, so I know it would be a windowless room. I put my ear to the door and hear something. A faint hum. I jiggle the lever, but it's firmly locked. The mattress. 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 I walk to Claire's bed, throw back the bottom corner of the spread, and slide my hand beneath the mattress. I pull out my hand and try another corner. It is there. A key. I grab it and stand. For once, I remember something about Claire that is useful. What are you doing? I slip my hand into my pocket. Nothing? Looks like something to me. I look at the ruffled corners. I was just straightening Claire's bed. She left it unmade. There's nothing else to do around here. Lily looks into my eyes, like she's searching for something. I finger the key in my pocket, and she watches, but doesn't say anything except, there's someone outside looking for you. I find Ethan on the front walkway. He shifts awkwardly and then smiles. He almost looks like he's in pain. "Hello," he says.
"Hello."
I look at him and wait, wondering what I'm supposed to do.
"Oh,"
he reaches into his jeans pocket.